The EMBO Young Investigator Program supports researchers who have been group leaders for less than 4 years. YIP members receive assistance for networking and benefit from training opportunities, support for lab members, and mentoring. We spoke to a YIP alumnus, immunologist Matteo Iannacconi, and a recently selected program member, neuroscientist Catherine Franken. Welcome to the EMBO Podcast. Immunologist Matteo Iannacconi heads a research group on host-virus interactions at the San Raffaele Research Institute in Milan. Our conversation took place in early December of 2021. Matteo started out as a medical student in Italy, and I asked him how he transitioned from medicine to research.
I did train as an MD in Milan, and during already my medical studies, I had some stints in research labs. But it was only part-time, as medical students can do. And I always had was going back and forth with the idea of being a clinician and then being a clinician or being a scientist. And it was really at the end of my medical training and the beginning of the residency that I stumbled upon a research seminar in an institute where a visiting scientist from San Diego actually gave a talk. And I was fascinated by the research subject. This was viral hepatitis and using different animal models to understand the immune pathogenesis of liver disease and viral clearance. And so I happened to, after the seminar, send an email and say, hey, I really liked your seminar. Can we have a conversation? And perhaps I would be interested in working with you. Because I had heard that this scientist, whose name is Luca Guidotti, actually was trying to establish a laboratory, so to come back from San Diego back to Italy to establish a lab within my institute. And so I thought, great opportunity, I can talk to him and see whether things would work out. And so I shoot an email with very little prior research experience, but for some reason he liked me. And he said, sure, let's work together. And so I thought he meant in Milan, but he said, no, I still have a lab in San Diego. So that's where I want you to go. And then I thought for 15 seconds and I said yes. And 2 weeks later, I was flying to the US. And after that, it was no turning back.
Recently, in one of the global immunotalks, you mentioned that one of the inspirations also for you to want to do immunology was the work of Rolf Zinkernagel. So what was attractive about that for you?
Absolutely. I was fascinated since the very beginning into in studying the immune system, into antiviral immunity. And I very much liked, I mean, of course, all his great work in discovering MHC restriction, but also more closer to the period where I actually started doing research. It was his view on antiviral immune responses in terms of evolution between virus and host. And so I liked very much, his concept of, immune responses being different between, for instance, cytopathic viruses and acute viral infections versus non-cytopathic and persistent viral infections. And that kind of theory there influenced me a lot.
And so you went to San Diego and the research concerns sound very close to, let's say, the physiology of infection and very cognate to the concerns of a medical doctor, and so hepatitis and viral infection. And then for your second postdoc, you went to the von Adrian lab, which is fantastic in many ways, but of course is really famous for being at the forefront of technology, particularly in imaging. Did you feel an acute need to learn or to develop new technologies for the problems you were interested in?
Absolutely. That's whereas, as I told you earlier, the choice of my postdoc in San Diego was very much at random or not really well thought out. For my second research experience, I actually really wanted to train into intravital microscopy. The reason being then I was studying at the time the pathogenesis of liver disease during viral hepatitis, and we stumbled upon the observation that platelets were actually required for T cells to home to the liver and to perform their effector functions there. And this was puzzling to us. And so we attempted to visualize the process. So there was a neighboring lab in San Diego by Zaveri Ruggeri, who was a world-leading expert in platelets. So we began to do some rudimental intravital microscopy experiments, first, ex vivo, and then trying to do in vivo. But that's when I stumbled upon the fantastic work from Uli von Andrian, as well as from Ron Germain and many others. And so I decided to train and to apply for a postdoc position with them. I actually applied to both Ron Germain and Uli von Andrian. Uli was faster in replying, and my wife also had found the job in Boston. And so I decided to do a postdoc with him, and it was a fantastic time. Actually, I did pitch to Uli the project on the liver, but then he kind of convinced me to work on something else, which is fine, because then I kept still this idea in the back of my head. And then when I started my own lab, I actually could get back to the original research question with my renewed training in intravital microscopy and address the problem.
So when the time came for you to start your own lab, you decided to return to Italy.
Yeah. So I started to look around for positions, and for some reasons, the best offer came from Italy. The reason being that I really wanted to do intravital microscopy in a biosafety lab, in a BSL-2, BSL-3 laboratory. And there are not many places in the world that have such facility. My institute did not have that, but we managed to convince them to build it for us. And so this is not like a trivial endeavor. And so that is what convinced me to really go back to Italy, and we could design our intravital BSL-3 facility as we wanted, and that's it worked out.
And actually, well, I wanted to thank you because, you know, we've had many great interviews in the podcast, but you were the only one so far that was kind enough to post a really interesting paper the day before the interview to make sure that we had a fresh topic to discuss. And it's this this paper from your lab in Science Immunology published yesterday, where this comes into play in a very big way, right? Because you're actually, unlike many of the wonderful papers on SARS-CoV-2 that have come out, you are not working with pseudovirus. You're actually working with SARS-CoV-2 itself, right? The actual pathogen. Making use of this BSL-3 facility that you had the foresight to set up. And can you tell us a little bit about the main conclusion of the paper? Because it sounds like it creates significant problems for some of the experimental models out there, not just from the point of view of the virus versus pseudovirus, but in the way people are inoculating the pathogen in animal models as well.
Yeah, sure. So this is hopefully the very beginning of our research efforts in trying to create better animal models to understand SARS-CoV-2 pathogenesis. I think this is very important because, despite the great success of the current vaccines, we still know very little about SARS-CoV-2 pathogenesis. And I think we shouldn't forget about this and do like we did for previous pathogens and really, study the pathogenesis of this infection. And so in this very first report that took us a while, but now hopefully we have some momentum and we can build on this. But the idea was, usually SARS-CoV-2 does not infect mice. And you can either do one of two things. Either you can adapt SARS-CoV-2 to replicate in wild-type mice, and this has been done, for instance, by Ralph Baric and others, or you can introduce the human ACE2 into mice. This has been done by many groups. Several transgenic mouse lineages have been generated, the most famous of which is probably this K18 human ACE2 transgenic mice generated by Paul Cray and Stan Perlman for the original SARS epidemic. And they express the human ACE2 under the cytokeratin 18 promoter. So they express ACE2 in all epithelial cells, or most epithelial cells. And the way these mice have been infected in the past was by intranasally inoculating or liquid suspension of SARS-CoV-2 under deep anesthesia. And we noticed that this results in some viral replication in the lungs, but mostly the virus would get access to the olfactory bulb and would cause fatal neuroinvasion and fatal encephalitis, severely limiting the usefulness of this model and also questioning the relevance of this model because SARS-CoV-2, especially latest findings, does not seem to be a neurotropic virus. So what we decided to do is we bought an inhalation tower that allow us to aerosolize SARS-CoV-2, create like respiratory droplets or small aerosol particles. And we can now expose mice to this aerosol for 15, 20 minutes, like it happens in humans. We do this with the nose-only apparatus, which allows the mice to spontaneously breathe. It does not. We don't need to anesthetize them. And then we compared the two routes of inoculation, basically intranasal versus aerosol exposure. And what we found is that in the aerosol exposure, despite very pronounced replication in the lungs, we do not get fatal neuroinvasion. Instead, we get replication in the upper respiratory tract, in the lower respiratory tract. We do get anosmia. And so we think this is might be useful to study a pathogenetic aspect of the disease. Another interesting thing is that we get a more pronounced lung pathology and immune infiltrates. The reason probably being that in intranasally inoculated mice, where there's pronounced CNS infection, you get some sort of immune suppression. And so most of the pathology that you get is really caused by the virus getting into the brain. And so we get more immune infiltration in the lungs, we get platelet aggregation, we get fibrin deposition, and so we get a lot of pathogenetic aspects that are also seen in some COVID-19 patients. So by simply switching the way we inoculated mice, we think that we have significantly improved existing mouse models. Now we have a large effort in the lab and we have already built additional mouse models that hopefully we will be able to characterize within the next months. You know, in vivo work takes much longer than you know, what the pandemic response usually wants. So it's faster to do analysis on infected patients, but it's difficult to do pathogenesis studies in vivo, which is what we are really interested in.
Well, I really enjoyed reading this paper because it also, to me, speaks to a broader point, which is when we discuss the limitation of animal models, it's often discussed as a species difference issue, that the species may or may not be adequate, which is often true, and it certainly is for some aspects, like the ACE2 variants or species-specific ACE2 differences. But there's now, this is another study in a series that shows that there are other artificial aspects of the models that people forget that don't have to do with the species. In this case, the inoculation method, but in the past, the floral variety, for example, the degree of cleanliness, the simple fact that we use isogenic mice. Often you can get something closer to a human phenotype by just using outbred mouse models of different types. So I think this is also part of a very, very important body of work that should remind people that the model is a model in many different ways, not just in the animal that you choose, but also in the techniques that you develop. And that in the end, if we stay with the same model for a very long time and don't tinker as you're doing, we may end up with overly baroque explanations of differences between species that may or may not exist. Right? So this.
No, absolutely. And if I can interrupt, I wanted to add that.
You should. It's your interview.
Right. No. I wanted to add that we think, of course, animal models and mouse models have many limitations, as you've pointed out. But I think they are extremely important still to the kind of research that we do. And sometimes I see a little bit a tendency of shying away or moving away from animal models and you know, focusing exclusively on, you know, the analysis on human patients or cell culture or organoids, which are very, very important. But I really think that there's still a huge space for animal models and refined animal models to study, you know, the complicated process that we study. I mean, the immune system cannot be studied exclusively in vitro. You know, you need to do in vivo work.
Yeah, I mean, Antonio Coutinho used to get furious when people would talk about tolerant lymphocytes. He would say the immune system is tolerant, the lymphocyte is not. It may be more or less responsive, but the fact remains, you take them, you put it in a different context, and they'll come out and kill your mouse all the same.
Couldn't agree more.
One of the many very interesting things you mentioned is the fact that you don't get a significant neuroinvasion here, but you do get the anosmia, right? And so what do you think is causing that?
Yeah, so I think this builds on previous work that shows that the infection of the olfactory epithelium, and particularly stromal cells there, like sustentacular cells or the Bowman glands in the respiratory epithelium, are the cells that are getting infected, and we see the same. And now it would be interesting to understand why this causes anosmia. I mean, is this a simple inflammation of the olfactory epithelium and the impediment of odorants to reach olfactory sensory neurons because of, you know, inflammation, or are there some other changes? So what we are planning to do now is we are doing some RNA sequencing in the olfactory epithelium and also combining perhaps with spatial transcriptomics and trying and see whether we can identify the culprits of anosmia, which seems to, in some patients at least, to be lasting for long periods of time, also past once virus is no longer detectable. And so this is something that hopefully within the next few months we will be able to address.
Matteo has in the past actively engaged in science communication for a broader audience and has stressed the importance of recognizing the uncertainty that is an integral part of research. Proper communication of doubt and uncertainty has been an Achilles heel during the COVID-19 pandemic. I asked Matteo if the pandemic affected his approach to speaking with the public.
Yeah, that's a great question. No, I don't think it did. I think you cannot convince everyone, and you know, the skeptics are always there, and the contrarians will always be there. But I think what we can do as scientists is trying to engage with, you know, responsible journalists or media, and there are still a number of them, and try to work with them in you know, engaging in a productive scientific discourse. I think it's pointless to chase, you know, 100% approval or that people would understand the uncertainty that lies in the scientific process. But at least you can try to sneak it in every time I have the opportunity. So I always do that in the few times that I've been involved in this kind of discussions in the last couple of years. So it has not changed this.
Matteo is a former member of the EMBO Young Investigator Program.
For me, it's been really very, very important to be joining the EMBO Young Investigator Program. Unlike other, you know, grants or awards that I had the lack of securing, it does not provide for much of research fund. But it provides for a fantastic networking opportunity. And so I met incredible scientists through the program who later became friends and fantastic collaborators. And I've started at least a couple of research projects that ended up in being published thanks to people that I met at the AMBO Young Investigator Program. I mean, I remember going for a run, for instance, with Florent Ginoux, who was also part of the AMBO Young Investigator Program. And you know, while running with him, you know, we came up with a project, you know, that we ended up doing together. And this is the kind of thing that you can only do with this sort of networking program. And I really like the fact that it's so broad in terms of, you know, it encompasses all life science. We usually go to meeting where you know, I meet immunologists or, you know, virologists if I'm lucky. But that's it. And this is like, you know, it is great that you have like this breadth of expertise. Then, of course, I mean, when you sit there in talks, I mean, maybe, you know, 50% of them, I hardly understand what they're talking about, but it's okay. I mean, at least you get some ideas and you look at tools that they might have or point of view that they use to address the research question. And this is, for me, has been phenomenal.
To find out more about Matteo's research, visit his group's webpage at yannakonilab.com. We now move from the immune system surveilling what's going on inside the body to the sensory systems looking at the outside world. Dr. Katrin Franke is a junior group leader at the University of Tübingen's Institute for Ophthalmic Research and Center for Integrative Neuroscience. Katrin became fascinated with sensory neuroscience during her university studies.
I think that was also kind of by chance. So I'm still interested in all on sensory processing in different senses. And during my master's program, we had different lectures, and one of them was about the retina. And I got very interested in how that actually neurons in the eye, and that the eye itself already does so much processing before the information is sent to the brain, that I decided to do my PhD in the lab of the professor that was giving this lecture. Yeah,
so that I was watching one of your lectures on YouTube. Yes. and you had this interesting quote where you say the retina is considered a mini brain in a dish. So I, yes. I guess that's a bit of what you were just saying, but could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So since decades, actually, people have studied how different neurons in the retina process visual information and have used it also as a model system of the brain, because when you think about it, it's relatively accessible compared to the brain itself. So you can remove the eye and you can isolate the retina, and the neurons, they will stay alive for several hours if you bath them in some like salt solution, and you can study how they process visual information. And importantly, you can even use the natural stimulus of the neurons, which is light. So you can just use a computer, like a projector that you might also use at home to project something on the wall, and you can use it to project movies or images on the retina, and you can study how the different neurons get activated by it, or what kind of features from this movie do they like versus do they not like. Yeah.
So that would be very different from, let's say, how the ear works, right? You wouldn't say that the ear is a mini brain in a dish. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, so I think in different, so that's actually true, that when you compare, let's say, the peripheral organs, sensory organs, that you have a lot of different neurons types already in the retina and a lot of processing in contrast to other sensory systems. And so one hypothesis is that in the visual system, you have the eyes and then you have the optic nerve, and all of the information has to pass through the optic nerve to reach the brain. And this is kind of the bottleneck of the visual system. So so that means that the neural circuits in the eye basically have to decide, okay, what kind of information from the outside world is important enough to be transferred to the brain. And this kind of filtering is computationally quite complex.
In one of your talks, you were also describing that many people, and I would include myself among them, usually think that the eye is just working, in a sense, collecting pixels and sending them to the brain, and that is definitely not the case, in the vertebrate eye, at least. So ultimately, what kind of information is the eye sending to the brain?
Yes.
If not little visual pixels, which is, I think, what a lot of people were not in the field.
Yes.
How they would imagine the eyes working.
So currently the idea is that the eye sends like parallel channels to the brain, and each of these channels is defined by a specific cell type. So these cells are called retinal ganglion cells, and that each cell type encodes specific features of the environment. And this can, for example, be you can have a cell type that's selective to motion in a particular direction. For example, if something moves from the bottom to the top, this neuron would encode this feature. Another neuron might be sensitive, for example, to an edge and will, or to a dark edge or bright edge, and will transfer this kind of information to the brain. And each of these single cell types, they cover all of the visual space. So you would, for example, it would tell you, oh, this one neuron is active now on the top left corner. So there's something moving from the top to the bottom in the left corner of your visual field, for example.
During her PhD research, Catherine and her colleagues revealed an unexpected level of complexity in the murine visual system.
I think since people have started recording from retinal neurons a long time ago, like nearly 7 decades ago, and have identified in the beginning that they have a relatively simple receptive field structure, so that they have a center and a surround. So if you shine some light in their center, the neuron would get excited, and if you would shine some light in their surround, they would get inhibited. And classically, the idea was that neurons in the retina filter the input or the incoming image with these relatively simple receptive fields before they send it to the brain. However, already early studies have shown, and there's one very nice study that's called What the Frog's Eye Tells the Frog's Brain, where they have already identified very complex cells, or cells with very complex response profiles. And one of them, for example, only responded when they showed like a small dark moving disc in its receptive field, and the cell did not care about like intensity differences or background motion. And they concluded that it might be ideally suited to as a bug detector, to detect a bug in the environment, so that the frog could, or this cell could, directly initiate a motor output to catch this bug. And I think this was like several decades ago, and since then people have tried to identify how many feature channels does the eye really send to the brain, and what do they encode. And so when I started my PhD here in Tübingen, I joined a project together with two other postdocs, and they were working on classifying the different feature channels the mouse eye sends to the mouse brain. And so I joined this project, and I did the functional imaging experiments where we recorded the neural activity of the neurons in the mouse eye to different stimuli. And then another postdoc who does computational neuroscience built like clustering algorithms to see how many different cell types can we really identify. And yeah, so to our big surprise, we identified more than 32 different feature channels from the mouse's eye to the brain. And at this time, this was approximately twice the number of previous estimates. And so I think this changed, or together with other work at the time, this changed the view that actually the mouse retina is very complex and sends or splits the visual image that comes in into many different feature channels. And since then, this has been confirmed in mice, both morphologically. So also morphologically, there are these many different cell types, and also genetically. And I think it's interesting to note that I think last year, two papers were published, one for chicken retina and one for zebrafish, also showing that in these animals, there are approximately 40 different channels that can be separated that go from the eye to the brain.
So this increase across such a large taxonomic range in the number of channels going from the retina to the brain, is this because the technology is there now to see this in greater detail, or are there other underlying reasons?
I think the foremost reason is probably that we have the technology to investigate these cell types at different levels, and also focusing on different modalities, both on the function. So we have these methods now to do large scale recordings from hundreds of neurons at the same time to visual stimuli. So we can gather a large data set. And if you have, let's say, 40 different cell types, you would require to have a large data set to actually be able to identify each one of them. And in parallel, the methods for single cell sequencing, dramatically changed the identification of cell types over the last years. And also the morphological classification of cells based on electron microscopy reconstructions of large samples. So I think that over the last years, just like many technologies advanced significantly in parallel, and that significantly helped the identification and separation of different cell types. Yeah.
So there was this maxim that you quote, the dumber the brain, the smarter the retina, or
yes.
To that effect. So I guess the primate retina would then not be a particularly complex computational device compared to what you're describing, or do you think it's just because we haven't brought that much of the new technical capacity to bear on primates, just because it's harder to work with and fewer groups working with them?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that all people who work on the retina would say that also the primate retina is a very sophisticated image processing device. And there are a lot of different neuron types that are highly conserved across primates and other vertebrate species. And I think the question mainly boils down to whether there are as many different output channels in the primate retina compared to now, for example, zebrafish or chicken or mice. And so currently the idea is that the peripheral retina in a primate is probably pretty similar to the retina of mice, for example. But the fovea, as I said, this region of very high photoreceptor, cone photoreceptor density, is a very specific adaptation of the primate. And this part is just very different than the retinas of other species.
And what are the physiological or behavioral consequences of that?
One consequence of the fact that primates and us humans, we have the spot of very high acuity vision is that, for example, if we want to look at anything or read something, we move our eyes a lot. I mean, you can see that now, or when I look at you, or when I read something, you can see that I move my eyes to left to right. If I look at a picture, people have recorded the trajectories of the eyes and have seen where do people actually look and how do they scan an image when they look at it. And so this is, for example, one of the most prominent consequences of having this one spot of high acuity vision. So if we want to see something, we just move our eyes to that spot. And interestingly, this is very different. For example, for mice, they don't really have a spot of very high acuity vision. And studies from the last years have measured eye movements of mice when they were freely moving. So they have built like a small camera on top of and mounted it on top of the mouse's head and have recorded the head motion at the same time as the eye motion while the animal was moving around. And they have found that for most of the times, the eye movements in mice, they tried or they serve to stabilize the image on the retina. So instead of having a small spot of high acuity, like primates, that we move around to see something, the eye movements in mice, they serve to stabilize the image on the retina, such that, for example, the sky always falls on the same part of the mouse retina and the ground always falls on the same part of the mouse retina. So that is one, behavioral consequence a consequence of the different organizations of the retinas of these species.
I'm just going to quote from a paper of yours in eLife a couple of years ago in 2019,
yes.
Where if we were doing clickbait on Twitter, we'd go, you'd never guess what happens next, where you say, at first glance, generating visual stimuli appear to be much easier than, for example, a factory stimuli because computer screens and video projectors are omnipresent, suggesting a range of cost-effective choices for the vision researcher. However, commercially available display devices target human consumers and thus are designed for the private visual system. So there is another shoe dropping here somewhere about the rodent visual system, right? What is it and what did you build to solve it?
Yes. So so this quote comes from a paper that we published a couple of years ago where we, in a collaboration with two other labs, we developed a visual stimulator that that is suitable for different model or can be adapted to different model organisms. And the reason or the motivation why we did this is that the different animals are sensitive to different wavelengths. And so, for example, us primates, we have three different cone photoreceptor types that are sensitive to blue, green, and red. And so all the display devices like computer monitors or also projectors, they are optimized to or they are built to optimally drive our visual system. However, many model organisms that are used in research, and the most common ones are, for example, mouse, zebrafish, and Drosophila, all of them have UV-sensitive photoreceptors. So they are activated by shorter wavelength light. And for example, in humans, actually, our photoreceptors might be sensitive to UV light, but our lens actually filters the UV light out of, the UV light only a very small fraction hits our retina in the end. But in these other model organisms, they are sensitive to UV light, so you would have to stimulate them with UV light to adequately drive their visual system. And so in this project, we built a projector that does not have any LEDs, but it has like a light guide port. So you can build an external LED unit where you could, for example, have a UV LED and a green LED and a red LED. And you combine this and couple this light into the projector using a light guide. And like this, you can adjust it specifically for different animal species like mice or zebrafish.
And one interesting word that's used when describing how you use this, for example, in your recent preprint in bioarchives, is naturalistic images.
Yes.
And I'm really curious about this because I assume you're taking mice that came from Jackson or Charles River and they've been in an animal house all their life. And then just from your slides and some of the images, I mean, the naturalistic images are grass and things like that, which seems to me would not be natural at all for a lab mouse. Do you think it makes any difference if the naturalistic image were, for example, the inside of a cage that is rotating or not?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question, and people address this once in a while. I mean, what does the domestication of mice or what does it do with their visual system? But in general, most people would say that, well, housing the mice or breeding the mouse like several decades is like relatively short in terms of evolution, right? So probably the visual system evolved over so much longer time scale to be adapted to the statistics of natural scenes, which then would be rather grass than the inside of a cage. But it is an interesting question. We have also performed, a couple of years ago, we have obtained mice that have not been bred as long in the lab, and they actually behaved very differently. So in the cage, they were going wild. And so you could really see how they showed a different behavior. But at the level of the retina, at least for the few experiments that we did not really observe any differences in the processing. But it doesn't mean that there might not be any adaptations over the course of several decades where the mice are just bred inside the cages and just see the cages. So, but I would still argue that the naturalistic stimuli for the mice would be rather grass than the cage. Yeah.
You finished your PhD in 2016?
Yes.
And then you started in January 2017 already as a junior PI. How was that decision? Was it easy to say, I'm not going to go somewhere to a postdoc or I'm going to start my own group? How was that thought process for you?
Yeah, so I think that's a little bit unconventional, not only that I went from my PhD directly to a junior group, but also that I stayed in Tübingen. I mean, the more traditional route would be to do a postdoc right abroad, like go to a different university, and then, I mean, later maybe come back. And so I was offered this position at the end of my PhD from the Bernstein Center for Computational Neuroscience here in Tübingen. And the position was like funding for myself and for a PhD student and some extra money to develop and work on independent projects. And this was running for 3.5 years. And so at the time, I mean, I thought about it, and it was actually a pretty great opportunity to directly go from the PhD into the PI position in an environment that, for example, provides the infrastructure also to already perform the experiments. And so, yeah, I decided to do that, and I think that was great. So it's, I think more and more universities, from what I hear, offer this opportunity to for like PhD students to transition directly into a more independent position and to do that for 3 to 4 years. And of course, it has disadvantages and advantages. So you, as a postdoc, you really have time to focus on your science for 3 or 4 years. You don't deal with a lot of supervision, maybe, or you don't deal with setting up, ordering stuff, and so on. So that's, I think, one advantage of doing the postdoc. But on the other hand, you get already early experiences with what it means to actually be a PI in science and to be an independent group leader in academia. And I think that is, for me, that it was very, very helpful and important, because in the end, this is what your work is about later on. And yeah, so I really enjoyed the time. And yeah, so I think for me, it was the right decision. Yeah.
You hear a lot of pros and cons of these programs, and yeah, some of them have been phenomenally successful. One of the things sometimes people are cautious about is what kind of access or how well you do at applying for independent funding.
Yes.
When you perhaps don't have that experience, but it varies a lot. Some labs, PhD students help write grants, some they don't, and so on. How was that for you?
So during my PhD, I did not significantly help with writing or applying for grants. So I had the opportunity to look at grant applications that were sent out, and that already helps, or being involved in the process or seeing different stages of the grant application, let's say from the beginning till the end. And so then I started to independently apply for funding after 2 years of this junior group position. And yeah, so I'm now here also in Tübingen, involved in a larger research consortium that works on robust vision and principles in biology versus in artificial vision systems. And this was one of the first instances where I was involved in acquiring independent funding. But it was nice to be in a group, to be in a consortium, because then you also get the experience from other people, and you have more exchange with colleagues about that. Yeah.
In 2022, Catherine Franke became a new member of the EMBO Young Investigator Program.
So I think one thing that is very special in academia, or people don't think about, is that during your undergraduate or your PhD, you mainly focus on science, and often also on your postdoc. But then at some point you become an independent group leader, and you have to deal with all kinds of things that you are not really prepared for. And also you're not really trained to do that. You have to, next to doing still doing excellent science, you have to supervise and mentor students and postdocs, and you have to manage a research team, and basically also serve in committee meetings and so on. And so I think that the EMBO Young Investigator Program is a really great program that offers young group leaders the opportunity or the support in this very challenging times sometimes, and beyond just funding for the research question. So basically it provides funding for going to conferences, not only for myself, but for the students, to interact with other EMBO Young Investigator group leaders and with other members of the EMBO community. And I think that's very valuable. Yeah.
To learn more about Catherine's research, visit the Frank Lab page at i-tubingen.de. The call for the EMBO Young Investigator Program is currently open. The deadline for pre-applications is April 1st, and full applications are due by July 14th, 2022. You can find out more about the benefits of the Young Investigator Program and how to apply at embo.org. Thank you for listening to the EMBO Podcast.